Radio Shack. Not much of in the way of parts anymore. And you send for parts, you have to send for parts. It seems like sometimes the mailing and the handling costs more than the parts themselves. Do you know of any places in the local area where you suggest that there is a possibility of obtaining small electronic parts for our project? I guess this is in lieu of discussing how to make a little PC board last week, Dick, over.
Mel, there's a little bit of hiss on your signal, so you could use a little bit more power if you had it, and your audio could be a little bit louder. But other than that, you sound good, not to worry. We were told last week that an awful lot of the parts that Radio Shack sells is at the Radio Shack website, even though the local store, your particular local store, might not have them. So by going to the Radio Shack website, which I'm guessing is something like shack.com, but I'm not sure exactly, but by way of Google, you'll find it. Also, the DigiKey catalog has lots and lots of parts, zillions and zillions of parts, at reasonable prices, and they don't have a minimum order. I know of nobody that has tried to order very small numbers of things from the DigiKey catalog that wasn't pleased with the response in dollars and time as to when they got a response. So those are two of my suggestions. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Mauser and Allied too, Dick.
Okay, do Mauser and Allied. I'm a little bit worried that Allied might have a minimum order. Back to you, John, for a comment on that.
Dick, I haven't ordered from them for a while, but they did not have a minimum last time I ordered, which was about a year ago.
Okay, so there's two catalogs. Allied Electronics, Mauser, and I think there's also Midwest Microwave. There's another one. I can't think of the name of it right now. That Rich N2EO has mentioned from time to time. So there's a number of catalogs, and so I think our local store, way back in the early days, we used to go to Harrison Radio, Arrow Electronics in Farmingdale. These were stores, and Barry Electronics in New York City. I think all of those stores are essentially gone as far as the parts department is concerned. Way back when, we used to also go to Lafayette Radio, but those were in the dark ages. I think now almost everything's got to be done by mail order, is my guess, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
N2EO, Dick.
Now, what is the name of that other company, Rich?
There's two. Surplus Sales of Nebraska and an Antique Electronic Supply in Tempe, Arizona. Even if you're not doing antique stuff, they have a lot of parts, a lot of chassis, butt cabinets, chassis, all kinds of stuff.
Very good, Rich. Good suggestion. So I know that what Mel does is that he goes up and down the streets when people throw out chunks of electronics, tape recorders, television sets, video cassette recorders, whatever. Inside of everything that's thrown out, there's all kinds of parts if you're willing to take them apart and catalog them. So when it comes to the cheapest possible source, that's one. But if you happen to live in a neighborhood where that's not available to you, it looks to me like almost everything's got to be done by either internet or mail order, so to speak, to really get the parts these days. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Roger. Well, the problem is that you send for parts, but first you got to have a sufficient order to make it worthwhile because, as you said, the handling charges, I seen because a friend of mine had to get a Veraxa diode. The diode, let's face it, that diode maybe was 90 cents, under a buck. And with the handling charges and everything, he said, would you believe to put this in an envelope, they charged him from, I think it either DigiKey or Mauser Electronic. I think they charged him like $7 or $8 handling charge, Dick. So, and you go to a Radio Shack, yeah, you go to the shack and, you know, look at the site and all that. But local Radio Shacks, I talk to them. They don't want to really involve themselves. And I says, well, can the parts come here and I come pick it up? Well, they give you a runaround. And they're not encouraging anymore, really, the sale of of parts. They've gone into a completely different line of, you know, commercial work, like selling TV sets and toys, electronic toys, and computers, and you name it, and things like that. So it doesn't seem that they're very encouraging, because they don't keep up even their parts drawers, really. A number of the drawers are either disheveled or missing most of the components, Dick, over.
I forget who it was last week that was telling us that certain Radio Shacks still do a good job of keeping those parts drawers and the bubble packs on the walls pretty well stocked. So it may be a matter of finding the right Radio Shack, or the right shack as it's now called. I think it's not called Radio Shack anymore. I think it's just now called Shack. Does anybody know of a shack at a particular address in the New York City area that you believe does a good job of keeping parts stocked? Give me a call that is right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
KC2RFM.
Alan recognized, and was there anyone else?
KB2MAR, Gabe.
KB2MAR, Gabe. Okay, Alan first. Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, the Radio Shack on Central Avenue in Lawrence is pretty well stocked. The drawers are pretty well filled, and they actually do a good job of separating out all the components, you know, so you don't have the same components from drawer to drawer. And they still have the largest number of pegboards I've seen with electronic parts, bubble packs, things like that. So I've been very impressed with them. Whereas another Radio Shack on Sunrise Highway in Lynbrook, not that far away, had none of that. I mean, literally none of it. So that one, they seem to be keeping it together. And I think the manager there is very knowledgeable electronics-wise, and that's probably why it's happening. Back to that.
Very good. So it looks like there's a lot of variation between the two. And I hope that Radio Shack, or Shack as it's now called, is not falling into the same trap of many other stores. Arrow Electronics in Farmingdale, way back in the 60s, had a whole lot of parts. You could go in there and buy disc ceramic capacitors, resistors, inductors. You could buy all kinds of things that were in their stock room, as well as appliances in the front room. And they were doing a very good business. The place was packed, particularly around Christmas time. Some efficiency expert came along and said, hey, the amount of dollars it's costing you to keep each one of these bins on the shelf in the back room for all these parts is not giving you the right kind of cash flow. You should drop parts. Well, they dropped parts. People stopped going there, and therefore they stopped buying the appliances, and the store soon failed. I think Harrison Electronics in Farmingdale went through a similar situation. Lots of people were going there because they had parts, and while they were there, they were also buying other appliances. Well, if you're not there to buy the parts and seeing their appliances, then you go to the discount stores to buy the appliances, and you don't go to that store anymore. So I think there's a lesson here. I see a definite trend. Each store that drops the thing that they think is not getting them very much profit, but it's the thing that gets the foot in the door of the potential customer. You got to, penny wise, pound foolish is a sort of a problem here. Gabe, where's your favorite store to buy parts? KB2MAR, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, don't forget KRP on the island. They have a lot of parts.
Okay, I'm going to come back to you on further information on that. Gabe first, go ahead.
Okay, this shack might be a little bit far from people on the island, but the Radio Shack in the Cross County Shopping Center in Yonkers, New York is fully stocked with all electronic parts they used to carry many years ago. There will be soldering irons, all types of solder, hookup wire, alligator clips, those types of things, pliers, what else do you have? All the typical capacitor resistors, transistors, and the little like drawers you slide in and out. What else do they have? They have electronic kits, the ones you actually pull the spring back. There are a few of those, but they have most of the snap type of kits they sell at that particular Radio Shack. Give it to me, I'll back to that.
Very good information, Gabe, and thank you for that. Barry, KRP, what town are they in now? When were you last there? And are they pretty well stocked? N2MB, K2RIW.
Okay, they just moved. It says here they're in Farmingdale now. I'm looking. Got a whole bunch of numbers here. I want to get their address. I have their phone number. Can I give their phone number out on the air?
I see no reason why not. You're not making profit from it. Go right ahead.
Okay, KRP Electronics, it says 631-694-2503. I'm trying to find their address. It's Farmingdale, New York, 11. It's got the zip code. Oh, here it is, 55 Allen Boulevard. 55 Allen Boulevard, Farmingdale, 11735. You don't need the rest of it. I'm sure that's enough. And that's the phone number I gave you was correct. I think I see another phone number? No, no, same phone number. Okay. So that's it for KRP. They just moved there. I don't think they've changed anything. I'm sure they didn't change anything. So they usually have about the best, especially small stuff. They're very well stocked.
That's a very good lead, Alan, Barry. And that's not far from me. I recognize that address. Allen Boulevard is an industrial park on the east side of Route 110, just south of Southern State Parkway. There's a whole bunch of industrial companies and warehouses and whatever in there on Allen Boulevard. So a good place to go. There used to be a number of surplus electronic places in there where I bought quite a few things in the past, but those were a lot of years ago. I don't know if they still exist. Very good. So it looks like with a little bit of digging, there are still places left where we can get parts, as I see it, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
And the problem is, if you got to be able to get Mama and Papa here to take you from Brooklyn out to Long Island or something, they are looking locally here. That's why I said locally. Sure, if you live out there near Allen Boulevard, great. If you have any place near one of these places like DigiKey or Mose Electronics, you can walk in, great. But here in Brooklyn, I thought possibly somebody had heard of some place that I haven't heard. If you walk into, let's say, three Radio Shacks within approximately a mile and a half or 2 miles of where I'm standing right now or sitting right now, and I've gone to all three of them and literally nothing. A few bubble packs of odds and ends, but nothing to speak of. I questioned them, and they just shrugged their shoulders. So I don't know whether the stores are being independently run now or whatever it is, but at least one store, in fact, two of the stores are on very main streets here, one on King's Highway, which is a main, big main, one of the, I guess, the main street almost of Brooklyn, and the other one on Flatbush Avenue, and that surely is a main street. Nothing doing, Dick, over.
By the way, Mel, your signal is quite a bit stronger, almost no hiss. Your audio is quite a bit louder. Sounding good. So the store that Gabe brought to our attention in Yonkers, I'd like to believe Yonkers is almost available by subway. Alan brought to our attention the store in Lawrence. Lawrence, you can probably get there by way of Long Island Railroad, but I don't know if the subway goes as far as Lawrence. I should know better about that, but I don't. Alan, KC2RFN. Could a person get to the shack in Lawrence by way of the subway? You got it, Alan.
Negative, Dick. Really, only by car. And it's probably best to go on a Saturday. The streets are pretty empty around that area on Saturday. Best time to go. That's when I go.
So you're saying it's not even close to a Long Island Railroad station, Alan? Go ahead.
Close to Long Island Railroad, guys. Definitely is.
Yeah, it's a bit of a walk, but you could do it.
But these young guys that Mel is talking to, they're rugged. If they got to walk a quarter of a mile to go to a place that's really got the parts, I think they'll do it. You got it, Alan. Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, Roger. I can see taking a trip. On the Long Island, taking from Brooklyn, a young person talking to parents into taking a trip and going there to get about $3 worth of parts or something. I gotta say, the traveling, the cost on to take the subway here to the where you've got to pick up the Long Island Railroad on Atlantic Avenue, and then from there out to Lawrence and come out of there and then take a taxi to the place and back. You can see that you'll spend five times the amount of money just for traveling. It's great when you live where you are, Dick, and you can go over there on a short trip and no problem. Or walk into a Radio Shack there out in Yonkers and things like that that have it. And that's all I wanted to know. Is there anything local here in Brooklyn? And I said, I don't know of anything else really than the Radio Shack. So I guess that's a dead issue here, Dick. You got to send for it or pay basically the same price traveling, I guess. So that, I guess that's the bottom line with this. Over.
Let me make a comment there. Yeah, I've got another suggestion, which is a long shot, but Alan first. Go ahead, Alan.
KC2RFN. You know, when I was a kid, that was an issue, too, and, you know, even a couple of bucks was a lot of money. It's always been an issue, and, of course, you don't have a car when you're a kid, and not every Radio Shack or electronics store is in bicycle riding distance. So what I did is there were three or four other people I knew from school who were also into electronics. And what we would do is we would get together sometime during the week and we would just write out a parts list and you know, what we wanted and what we thought we might want somewhere down the line. And that's how we got around the minimum, you know, purchases, and you get it sent to one guy's house and then distributed from there. And that was very effective because we would get together at somebody's house and look at their projects, and you'd learn something as well. And you find out they have a spare part that you need, you have a spare part they need. You know, it really is cooperation. It's always that way. You don't learn in a vacuum. So you get together with a few people, and that's how you get around the problem. KC2RFN.
KC2OJO with a comment.
Go right ahead, Howard.
I was just going to mention that there's different type of minimum fees. If you got a DigiKey, I believe they're going to charge you $5 handling unless you go above $25 in your order. There's another company, Jameco, J-A-M-E-C-O. They also have a minimum fee of $5, but it's only if you don't exceed $10 in parts. So it's a lot easier to, you know, order $10 or $11 worth of parts than $26 worth of parts for the, and avoiding the $5 charge. Back to net.
Quite a good suggestion, Howard. One other long shot here, Mel. If the group is large enough, and this is a tough one, the Radio Society of Great Britain, 20 or so years ago, had a group of guys that were really interested in microwaves, and yet the parts they needed, like waveguide to coax adapters, crystal detectors, small feed horns and whatever, they had a group of guys that were literally building these things with their own hands and shipping them among the members at very reasonable prices. So they were forming a group which had a parts, the equivalent of a parts catalog of what the average microwaver really needed. I wonder if there's enough of your guys there in Brooklyn that can form a group which, either following Gabe or Mel or anybody else's suggestion, can make an order that's large enough to get around the minimum fee, or, I guess, again, come up with a parts list, and if sometime in the next week a person is going to one of these locations like Lawrence or Yonkers, that has a known good shack, then they can pick up all these parts. It looks like some form of group effort maybe would be helpful. I didn't say it's easy. K2KEY, K2RIW.
It's really a shame that there's nothing here in Brooklyn, in fact, even into the city. Now, I've canvassed a number of Radio Shacks, I can say, local ones here, found nothing here. In fact, there's one I've just mentioned on Flatbush Avenue here in Brooklyn, right near the, what is called King's Plaza. That is one big place, the Radio Shack over there. It takes up, they opened up, they kept breaking through and adding more. Now they've taken over the area of three stores. And you walk in there, absolutely, I was quite amazed that they really had so little in a way of components. Actually, I could say almost nothing. You open up even the drawers where they supposedly had connectors and things. I would say the drawers are either disheveled to the point where you're not going to find much, or they've just never been, you know, no maintenance on it. I mean, it's just been, like, forgotten, I guess, and waiting for it to completely empty out, and then we'll throw the drawers out. I mean, that seems to be the attitude. So, and it's a shame, even into the city. I have walked into a couple of radio shacks in the city, and basically the same thing. Let me let it drop. I'll make a final comment, and then we'll go on. Okay, as far as I could say, you know, the parts, you know, you're working on a little project. That's why Dick has basically a good idea, and that's what I've been working with to a great extent. It's amazing how much it fills in when you need a resistor, a capacitor, almost all that kind of small parts, diodes, common transistors and things like that are available from old TV sets, VCRs, DVDs, or you name it, just for the taking. So that is a good source. I have tons of boards, and they're everything from commercial boards right down to, like I say, old TV boards and all. And I have cannibalized a heck of a lot. And only the key parts, sometimes specialized key parts, I have sent for from either DigiKey, Mose Electronics, or Janeco, or one of those others, or wherever they suggest. And have to, unfortunately, in many cases, just order maybe that one IC and pay the fare. What can I do? It's cheaper than traveling, so that's the bottom line. Okay, I think we've done as much we could with it. Dick, back to you.
I've got one last suggestion, Mel. You and I are almost of the so-called dumpster diving philosophy of life. If people throw things out, we'll look in that refuse can and see what's of value there. And I found some tremendously valuable things in dumpsters and the places where they collect so-called refuse in industrial places. One of my sayings is that you can tell how well a company is doing by what they throw out. And some of the companies I've done some consulting for, in their so-called garbage cans, the circular file that's alongside of many of the desks, just by looking down into the circular file as you walk by and you see things, wow, there are times I've picked up some very valuable stuff. Now, in the old days, people used to put the television set out in front of the street, the garbage man picked it up. Nowadays, if you really are a green person, there is a recommended procedure by which you're supposed to dispose of electronic parts. Somebody's afraid that it's going to be leaching lead into the environment. I'm very skeptical of that. I think the rate at which lead comes off of a printed circuit board is extremely slow, but that's my belief. However, wherever this green collecting place is, I mean, however was the recommended procedure in each community for disposing of electronics, it's being collected somewhere. Is there a way by which we can get access to that spot and pick up some of these printed circuit boards? I know that it's going to be hard. I suspect that the legal beagles are going to say there's too much liability risk. We can't do that. I wonder if anyone knows of a way that possibly could be done. Give me a call letters right now. KQLIW in the TechNet.
No, no, no. Thank you.
Not
absolutely no salvaging. They have a place here in Brooklyn. And it's we got a big sign up there. Anyone caught attempting to salvage will be issued a summons. No scavenging. Absolutely not, Dick. That's the bottom word. In fact, it has gotten to the point now where it is actually illegal to pick up stuff in the street. You get caught picking up anything in the street that's put out, like electronics and all, you are actually subject to a summons. There is no more junk bin wandering the streets up and down. You're not allowed to pick up old appliances. You see junk bin come down the street. Hey, see an old stove thrown out, you know, from the kitchen. You put a new kitchen in, you threw out the stove, the dishwasher, or whatever, the sink. You cannot touch it no more legally. This is property of the city of New York for material salvage and everything. Air conditioning. You must call in for an air conditioner or refrigerator put out to have the coolant removed by them, and then they put a sticker on it for the regular pickup. You have to call in 311. This is what the regulations are now here, Dick. Over.
Wow, I was afraid of that. There was another person that Mel doubled with, but Mel dominated, not to worry. We heard everything you said, Mel. Who was the other person who had a comment? Give us your call letters, name, and your comment right now.
This is Dave again. I was mentioning that if someone wants parts, the colleges are always throwing out old equipment. And most college buildings have, like, loading docks. And they have just stuff laying around there. I believe anyone can go there and just take it. Dave, it's your mail back to Ness.
Now, that's a very good suggestion, Gabe. There is a college local to me that I was visiting because of a meeting, and I saw a dumpster out back, and in that dumpster, in perfect prime condition, was an extremely elaborate, older piece of equipment, but very, very valuable to me, a 0 to 30,000 volt electrostatic voltmeter with a great big mirrored scale on it, and it's got four or five different voltage ranges from 30 kilovolts all the way down to like 5 kilovolts full range. To me, a very valuable piece of equipment being thrown out. That was just one of a number of things that college was disposing of. So I'd like to believe on college property, when you're there for a meeting, that you're really not going to run into this problem like Mel does in New York City, that when something is put out, it becomes the property of the city. I guess what you'd have to do in a case like that, Mel, is talk to the owner of that house, convince him to walk it back into his house, and then convince him to give it or sell it to you. I think that's the only way you could find something out front and legally get your hands on it. But even that, I imagine, there's some kind of rule against it. My goodness. It looks like the number of rules in New York City are getting awfully large, Mel. K2KEY. Go to the next one if you'd like to. K2RIW.
Quick comment, Dick?
Go ahead, John.
Dick, these people also searching for this stuff, if they watch Craigslist, a lot of times you'll see a listing where you can pick it up at the person's home, no charge. They're going to put it out to the curb, but you can make arrangements. That's a good source for TVs and all type of electronic stuff that's going to be thrown out, just to let you know.
That's good to know. I'd like to believe that the rules are not so strict there in Staten Island when it comes to things put out front for a crafty guy walking along being able to pick them up without getting a summons. Back to you, Mel, and go to the next letter if you want to. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger. No, same to all five boroughs of New York City. That is the Department of Sanitation's regulation. Like I say, got an official letter from them explaining that newspapers and things, paper products, is put out and is not to be picked up other than by the Department of Sanitation and the regulations for appliances and everything, how to call 311 and go online how to make arrangements for its disposal. It's a problem here. Like I say, they keep coming up with new and new regulations here to make you crazy. You got to think twice about everything, you know, what you're doing, because somebody's going to point the finger and say, aha, you got to write your summons for something. For instance, just quickly, you're not supposed to put out your garbage for pickup before 2 hours before it's the pickup time, and the can's supposed to be off the street 2 hours after. Within 2 hours after the pickup. Now, a number of people have complained here that, hey, we're working. What are we supposed to do? We can't take the can until we come home. And they got summonses. And don't ask what's been going on. It's ridiculous. All right, shall we go on with another one? Over.
Somebody has a suggestion. May I go ahead? Go ahead with the next one, Mel.
I've got off this thing a little bit, but that's the situation here. So I sympathize with a lot of young people. It's not as easy as it was, like you say, in our time, Dick. Go to Cortlandt Street, places like that. You had everything or number of local places. So a little different world. All right, I'm just looking here. Okay, here's one. We're bringing that we were talking about different things. A long wire antenna, random length wire, I was told, should have a P network antenna tuner. What is the difference between a PI type and a T network antenna tuner? And why do they suggest T network for random long wires? Okay? Good subject, Nick. Go ahead.
Yeah. Any length of wire can be forced into being an antenna, as long as you've got the right impedance matching network. And that impedance matching network, call it antenna tuner if you like, if it's mounted close enough to the antenna so that the feed line is not giving you a lot of loss because you're running with a very high standing wave ratio, any length of line by the antenna tuner is being forced into electronic resonance, even though the length may be wrong. The extra length is being added by the electronics. And I think somebody has come to the conclusion that a T network, by the way, random lengths of wire, when they're non-resonant, non-resonant really means you're going to get an extremely large capacitive reactive component or an inductive reactive component. But one of those reactive components is going to be a great big number, like 1,000 ohms or more, when the antenna is off resonance. That's the usual rule of thumb. And therefore, your impedance matching network has to be able to tolerate a very large reactance. And can a T network do that a little bit better than a PI network? Maybe the answer is yes. However, I am convinced that Mel and Dick would be able to take any well-designed PI network and force it to be a perfect impedance match to their open wire, to their long wire antenna, non-resonant wire antenna, because we're smart enough to use a trick. We know that no matter what antenna tuner you've got, I don't care if it's pi, t, t pi, l, whatever, they all cover a certain area. Let me drop. As you tune their controls throughout all of their range, they're covering up a certain area of the Smith chart. A Smith chart is a circular chart where every possible impedance in the world is on that chart. The far left-hand side of the chart is the resistive component going toward 0 ohms. The far right-hand side of the chart is the resistive portion going toward infinity in ohms. The 12 o'clock position of the chart is going toward infinity in inductive reactance. And the 6 o'clock position on the chart is going toward infinity in capacitor reactance. So every possible impedance you can think of in the world is somewhere on that chart. And every antenna tuner covers some percentage of the chart, maybe 60%. And maybe it's a great big amoeba-shaped object on the chart where your particular antenna tuner can cover. And once you know that your particular antenna is a dot on that chart, and maybe it's a really wild impedance, and it's outside of the area where your antenna tuner can cover, the magic about adding an extra length of transmission line, if you're using 50-ohm line, add another 20 feet of line, so to speak. Or if you're using open wire line, add an extra length of line. But by changing the length of the transmission line, you're taking your dot of your impedance on that Smith chart, and you take that dot and connect your pencil of your compass to it, take the sharp point of the compass, connect it to the center of the chart, and swing that compass and draw a circle. Your impedance of your antenna will walk along that circle as you stretch your transmission line. The bottom line is choose the right length of transmission line. And I don't think you can find an impedance that you're not going to match with the particular antenna tuner that you own. So that's one way around the problem. I wonder if you've done things like that, Mel.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
K2KEY, K2RIW, I bet you've done that, Mel.
Yes, Roger. In fact, if you look in the amateur radio antenna book, you'll see simple things like L networks. And yes, for random wires, they do work real well. And in this case, in fact, they show you simple homebrew versions. It'll be a lot less than buying a tuner. The cheapest tuner around will cost more if you just buy a couple of components. And the components usually just consist of a coil and a capacitor. and you can put it all together on a wooden chassis. This is a very, also, I want to bring this out, this is a misnomer, that a tuna has to be in a metal case. Yeah, it looks nice when they sell you one for $1,500. It's in a nice metal case with nice knobs on the front and everything. But you can build the whole thing onto a piece of wood chassis, a wood, this case, a wood piece of wood with a front panel to be made out of a piece of aluminum if you want to finish it nice or whatever. And you can put it together as they show you there in a number of different configurations. And one of the configurations is an L network. Works extremely well, and you can buy the component. These components are available to buy from Surplus of Nebraska. So that's what I would suggest. In fact, I can say it'll be much cheaper than purchasing any of the tuna stick, over.
And you're bringing back some memory here, Mel. Many of the guys that I used to visit, serious high-frequency operators in the 50s and 60s, they were so proud of their antenna tuner because it had a great big air-wound, silver-plated coil, a great big variable capacitor with great big spacing between the plates, and they were proud to display this exotic piece of electronics. It frequently was mounted on a piece of mahogany, and it sat on top of the transmitter, open to visualization because it's such a pretty looking thing. And like you said, there's nothing magic about shielding it, with rare exception that you had an extremely short-circuit-like antenna, as the impedance that it sees at your end of the transmission line in the shack, under that condition where the circulating currents in the antenna tuner could be extremely high, you may get a little bit of radiation off of that. But that's a rare case. So it doesn't have to be a shielded structure. The coil itself is essentially shielded. The capacitor itself is essentially shielded. And you're not going to operate with your head 1 inch away from that while you're pouring a kilowatt into it. That would not be recommended. But any reasonable distance from it, I think it's pretty safe. And there's lots of ways you could test as to whether or not the condition is safe. A simple neon bulb with a couple of wires hanging off it will tell you if you've got a whole lot of RF in the shack. And there's a lot better ways of building a RF field strength meter if you really want to do field strength measurements and to be double darn sure that there isn't RF in the shack because you've got an unbalanced transmission line. I mean, in the old days, you would find out you've got an unbalanced condition and RF in the shack because you're using a metal-cased D104 microphone, and as you walked up close to it, you drew a small spark between your lip and the microphone. We don't run into those things anymore, Bell. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, I still use the D104 mic, thankfully. I don't get those little ticks. I could say if your antenna is reasonably set up. Yes, as I said, I have built those tuners way back in cigar boxes. What else? And anything I've put, antenna matching units, manually tuned ones. I've had homebrew ones that I've tuned at a distance. Waterproof plastic boxes with a little motor on it, a little two-way motor, and things of all that I've gone through. So there's no really, like I say, so any kind of specialized, high-tech work that has to be done that requires, machining or anything. It's just simple. It's a simple device to put together. So don't look at those tuners. I know they are putting out, I believe now there is a market now for tuners for random wires and all. But you can, like I say, I don't think you're going to go for more than a few parts, 3-4 parts, the whole thing, actually 2 connectors, maybe a couple of connectors, a variable and a coil, and that's the whole story, and then easily put it together. So don't let it, that word, T networks and all that throw you. Look in the handbook. You'll see some very easy ways of doing it. I think, Dick, over.
There's a beautiful website done by Berkeley, the Berkeley College in California. And if you just Google the word Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, I think it is, and impedance matching, you will find a beautiful website where you simply tell that website, you tell that computer program, it's not even a computer program, it's a visual. It's a bunch of open lines on a screen where it's asking you what is the resistive component of your load, what is the reactive component of your load in ohms, and you make it positive in ohms if it's a capacitor and negative in ohms, positive if it's an inductor and negative if it's a capacitor, when you're filling in the reactive component, and what is the impedance of your signal generator, and you press go, and in a fraction of 1 second, it gives you 16 solutions with the diagram of each of the solutions. It'll show you a pi network, a T network, an L network, a reverse L network, an upside down pi, and whatever. It gives you 16 solutions in a fraction of a second with the diagram telling you the exact values in picofarads. Oh, it asks you also the frequency you're at. It tells you how many picofarads and how many microhenries is required to use the circuit to make a perfect impedance match for your particular environment. So now the hard part, of course, is you might not know what is the impedance of your random wire antenna. And so by way of an impedance matching device, if one of your guys in your club owns one, there's ways you can measure it. But still, if by some way you can find out what the impedance of your antenna is, Berkeley will tell you exactly the solution, and you choose of the 16 solutions, maybe two of them are non-solutions, and it tells you that because the values are beyond reasonable, but you then choose the solution that has the easiest layout and the most...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You choose the easiest solution and the one that's got the most convenient values of the inductors and capacitors that you happen to own. So, as long as you've got that one little bit of knowledge, what frequency you're at and what the exact impedance of your antenna or network is. Maybe it's a transistor. And the data sheet on the transistor has told you that at your favorite frequency, at your power level, it's 5 ohms of resistive input and 45 ohms of capacitive reactance. And Berkeley will tell you the exact solution you're looking for. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger. In fact, that's why I like the that homebrew versions that they show you on a piece of wood, because you can then set it up and try. You can actually try an L network, T network, a pi network, you know, any of those configurations. You can easily go from one to the other. Put it together very simply, that you just have to switch some wires around and get an idea. One of them, you'll see how it works, and if you would like to try another one, go back and try another one. If it's the other one works better, no problem, switch it back. That's basically very straightforward. So as Dick says also, you can consult them, but if you're not sure and you'd like to experiment, believe me, like Dick says, nothing's going to explode, nothing's going to burn or anything like that. And if you have a handheld, one of these handheld antenna analyzers, oh, you can have a grand old time trying different matches and not having to fire up your transmitter and just sitting there. You can actually put your hands on it while you're doing anything and not worry about getting an RF burn or whatever. So it's plenty of experiments, and yes, go for it. Long wires, random long wires in many cases work quite well if this is your situation you're dealing with. Okay, yes, we can go on with the tech now. It's almost 10 o'clock, so continue on, Dick. We'll let this all go for next week. Anything further? Go ahead.
Okay, sounds to me, Mel, like you think you have answered enough of the mail questions. Now, you did say open wire line behaves correctly as long as it has a balanced load. If I've got my 600 ohm line, open wire line, and I put a pure 600 ohm resistor across the end of it, no sweat. The signal flows down the line, hits the resistor, gets absorbed, nothing reflects, no standing wave ratio, everything is hunky-dory. If I leave the 600 ohm resistor across the end of the open wire line, and I take one of the leads of the open wire line and ground it to a great big chunk of copper, or ground it to all of the ground plane radials of the quarter wave ground plane antenna that's in the backyard, the vertical antenna. In my opinion, Mel, I have now, even though I haven't changed the real load that's there, the 600 ohm resistor, I have now created an imbalance. The end of that line, I have forced the voltage with reference to earth to be 0 volts on one line. Therefore, the voltage on the other line has just doubled, and it's the equivalent of having a second transmitter out there sending a signal back down in the common mode manner. I have created a common mode signal that's going to flow back on that transmission line. I know this is a controversial subject. It's not an easy one to handle. I know a lot of people have trouble with this one. But let me find out your opinion on that so-called experiment, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Exactly. See, this is now a unique situation. And a good analogy is if you take, like, for instance, two wires from a battery, and how would I explain it? I have to explain it different. Like, for instance, if you had two wires and you measured in a small fraction of a microsecond, then the pulse that is of current that's flowing on a battery terminal during the time can be represented as the vertical line, and you can then see that unique position. I'm trying to visualize how I explained it, but using that as an analogy, that the difference, what happens with the two currents on the line, Dick. I know what you're talking about because I did the demonstration for a group of people using a battery, and I'm trying to remember the exact words, how I put it, how I demonstrated, but I'm trying to get into my mind exactly what you have in mind, and I know where you're coming from, Dick. Over.
Yeah, as long as we can all accept the principle of superposition of voltages and whatever, I think I can explain Howard's situation in a slightly different manner. Instead of putting a 600 ohm resistor across the end of the 600 ohm line out in the backyard, I put a pair of 300 ohm resistors in series. No problem. The open wire line still sees 600 ohms. Now, if at the center tap of that pair of 300 ohm resistors, I put a second signal generator on the exact same frequency. I did it by phase locking to make sure they're on the exact same frequency and the exact same phase. And I adjusted the voltage coming out of that signal generator with reference to the copper sheet. The signal generator now has a piece of coax cable coming out of it. The braid goes to the copper sheet. The center conductor goes to the junction between the two 300 ohm resistors. And if I now, if the original signal generator in the shack feeding a 2-volt signal down the 600 ohm open wire line, a 2-volt peak-to-peak signal. Let me make a 2-volt RMS. At any one instant of time, with 2-volt RMS between the two wires of the open wire line, at one instant of time, I could say the right-hand wire is plus 1-volt, and the left-hand wire is minus 1-volt at one instant of time. Half cycle later is reversed. So plus and minus 1-volt is occurring with reference to ground. 2 volts peaked, is the differential between the two ends of the line. And at the center tap of that pair of 300 ohm resistors, I put a 1-volt signal generator that's in phase with the signal coming out of the open wire line. So I've got a 2-volt signal in the shack across the two lines. I got a 1-volt signal generator with reference to ground.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I got a 1-volt signal generator in the backyard connected to that copper sheet, and the hot lead is coming to the center conductor of those two resistors. Because the signal generator in the backyard at one instant of time is putting out plus 1 volt, and because the signal generator in the shack feeding the open wire line is creating plus and minus 1 volt with reference to ground on each of those two lines of the open wire line, I can then take the minus 1 volt coming from the shack generator on the left-hand wire, the plus 1 volt coming out of the signal generator in the backyard, add the two together. The left-hand wire is now got 0 volts with reference to ground continuously. The right-hand wire has got 2 volts with reference to ground continuously. I've done it with two separate signal generators. It's kind of obvious that the way I'm feeding the center tap of those two 300 ohm resistors with the 1-volt signal generator in the backyard. Let me drop. Very few people would doubt that that signal generator in the backyard is launching a 1-volt common mode signal down that transmission line in the reverse direction. It's a 1-volt signal, and it's being equally applied to both sides of the transmission line. So you can see that I've now forced a 1-volt common mode signal flowing back down the transmission line. Well, I don't have to use that second signal generator in the backyard. All I've got to do is ground one of those wires of the open wire line to that great big copper sheet in the backyard, and I've done the same thing. Obvious by the fact that when I did it with the signal generator, one wire had 0 volts with reference to ground, the other one had 2 volts. And now when I do it by grounding one of the wires without using the second signal generator, I get the exact same thing. 0 volts on one wire, 2 volts on the other wire. So no matter how I do it, I'm launching a 1-volt common mode signal by having an unbalanced load. So unless I've got some other kind of very fancy balancing device at the end of that transmission line, when I'm feeding a dipole off-center, I am forcing a common mode signal on that transmission line. Wonder if anyone's got further comments, questions, or whatever on what I just said. I know it's not easy the first time you hear it. K2RIW listening.
KC2OJO.
Howard recognized, and out of curiosity, is there anyone else we should put on the list for this one?
K2KY, I'll say a couple more words about this.
Okay, so we're going to go to Howard and Mel in that order. Howard, you've got it.
Okay, let me just simplify my thoughts. The first part you answered, if I had 1K looking into the resistive, the long arm, and 1K capacitive in the other arm, if I'm up at the antenna there and I have a balanced output, I just have to resonate it with the 1K impedance in the generator and I'm good to go. Now, let me take my transmission line, my open wire transmission line, and forget that it's an antenna, and I'm just going to connect across the two wires at the antenna, throw away the antenna, 1K resistive in series with 1K capacitive. Now I travel down my transmission line, I look at the Smith chart, wherever I am, and I basically match it. I guess it's with a complex conjugate, so I should be able to transfer the power, and I'm coming from a truly balanced source. So my question is, will the line radiate under those circumstances? I merely have a complex load at one end of the open wire transmission line, and I'm driving properly from the other end with a truly balanced load. How could the transmission line radiate at that point?
That's a darn good example you've given us there, Howard. Believe it or not, there are two separate answers to the puzzle you just posed. If I had a nice insulated box where the end of the 600 ohm transmission line entered the box, and inside the box I hung those components you just mentioned, maybe it's a 1000 ohm reactor and a 1000 ohm resistor or whatever, I hung those components inside of that small insulated wooden box, and I created this improper impedance loading the transmission line. And then if I walk back down the transmission line, 1 foot, 10 foot, whatever, and I put an impedance matching device. Now, the transmission line from that impedance matched point all the way back to the shack would not radiate. But the portion of the transmission line between that impedance matching device and the box would not radiate for those components in the box. But now I put on the real antenna that has the exact same impedance on the left-hand side of the wire and the right-hand side of the wire. Believe it or not, that's a different condition. Let me drop it, I'll tell you why. The components of the exact same impedance of the antenna that you had in the small wooden box was a thoroughly floating, finite element set of components. In other words, very small dimensions of elements, your components in the box are very small compared to a wavelength. Those components are thoroughly floating with reference to local ground or the rest of the universe. They are small components, small in wavelength, thoroughly floating, no common mode impedance between them and ground. But a real antenna, where the wire of the antenna, at least one of the wires of the antenna, has a substantial length compared to wavelength. Once you've established a wire in free space, a substantial length compared to a wavelength, it has a certain impedance to Earth, it has a certain impedance to the universe. It is no longer floating. And if it's an imbalanced impedance, it now launches a signal, a common mode signal, back down the line. So, with your impedance matching device, would it correct the problem and would no radiation take place? You can see there's a yes or a no, depending on whether or not the load is small dimensioned components versus a really large dimensioned antenna. You'll get two different answers and two different amounts of radiation on your table. I don't blame you for being skeptical about this at first. KC2OJO, K2RIW.
Dick, would this also be true if you were not on Earth, but you were pretty much in space? Would the length of the wire still come in exactly the same way?
Don, good question. I'm glad you asked it. The phenomena will still take place, but to a slightly different degree. That great big long piece of wire in your backyard not only has an impedance to the universe, but it has an impedance to Earth. If I now did it as an astronaut floating a mile behind the space shuttle in orbit, and really in free space, I'll get a slightly different a magnitude of common mode, but I'll still have a common mode. There's a series of experiments you and I could do by off-center feeding a dipole in free space, out in the in orbit, so to speak. And you'll soon discover that that piece of wire, as long as it's got a substantial fraction of a wavelength of length, it has an impedance to the universe. The best example I know of this is a puzzle that somebody posed, which asked the question, what is the capacitance between the Earth and the Moon? If I had a great big long piece of wire between the Moon and another long piece of wire from the Earth, and I'm sitting midway between the two, and I measure the capacitance between the two, and by some means I do it at a low enough frequency where the length of the wire is not a substantial inductor, and you calculate that impedance. You calculate that impedance, you'll come up with something like, I seem to remember, a tenth of a microfarad. And the real impedance is about five times larger than that, because the Moon has a certain capacitance to the rest of the universe. The Earth has a certain capacitance to the rest of the universe. And two things capacitive connected to the same thing called universe have a certain additional capacitance to each other. The real capacitance is a much bigger number. So your antenna, you may not think it, but because it radiates a signal to that universe, it is connected to that universe with a certain impedance. Over to you, Howard, KQLIW in the TechNet.
Dick, that clears it up quite a bit to me. I think what you're saying, this probably has to do with what we would measure as the 377 ohms, perhaps, of free space. But I was really getting kind of confused because the model I had two models. I had one model where I tried to take the antenna into account, and it seemed different than the lumped circuit, as you described it, in the wood box. And I couldn't understand why you would have your transmission line radiating if it were truly lumped circuit at one end and you were driving it properly at the other end. We're seeing there's really something a little bit mysterious called free space out there that its presence felt differently to the two sides of the transmission line. Back to that.
You've got it, Howard. By the way, Howard, each time I pass it back to you, you have been forgetting to wait for the beeps, and you were kind of lucky you didn't time out the machine. So don't transmit immediately each time I pass it back to you. But yes, the 377 ohms is part of it, and it's not an easy concept to understand. But each substantial piece of wire compared to a wavelength, you know, more than a tenth of a wavelength, I'm going to say, has a certain amount of impedance to the rest of the universe. You could say that impedance to the rest of the universe allows it to be a radiator. And that's overly simplistic, but maybe it helps a little bit. But it's kind of hard to believe that the two halves of the dipole